Today we start Revelation. You may have all sorts of feelings going into this: confusion, curiosity, trepidation, dread. As with all of Scripture, however, remember this: we will meet God here. There is going to be a lot of wrapping paper, but there's still a great gift in here. Do not be afraid. God does not morph into a dreadful ancient deity. Jesus is in this story. And although we will be shown a view of Jesus as king, we will also still see his tender, merciful heart. Do not be afraid. First, I want to mention that about 20 years ago, I did a series of teachings on Daniel and Revelation from a traditional evangelical point of view. And this was before I went to seminary and before I had studied Greek and Hebrew and before I had access to the vast resources that seminary made available to me. Back then, I was working from my grandfather's library, plus the Interpreter's Dictionary of the Bible, several books on Revelation that I'd collected on my own, and my handy Strong's Concordance. Now, I have much more background and knowledge than I did then. I have read recent scholarship. I have been taught by world-class professors. I still don't have all the answers. There's no such thing. But my understanding of Revelation has undergone a significant shift. Did I take those old podcasts off of my website? Nope, they're still there. The work I did was solid and is still helpful to those who view these prophecies through that lens. But my approach to this class will be different. The elements are the same, of course. It's the same scripture we're studying, but how I put the elements together and how I relate them to their historical context has changed. And as a result, my conclusions have changed. I don't see this as a failure, only as a sign that I'm still learning and still growing. Back then, I thought I had to make every single piece of prophecy in the Hebrew Bible, the New Testament, and Revelation fit together in a precise, chronological, theological, and literal way. I understand now that we need to view Revelation through the lens of the early Christians who struggled to survive within the Roman Empire, and through their lens of the Hebrew Bible. We also need to understand that Revelation is a particular type of writing. Most of it is apocalyptic literature, which was a very popular genre at the time, still is for that matter. We just call them post-apocalypse movies nowadays. So let's start by positioning Revelation in its historical context. The first question, of course, is who wrote Revelation? The author names himself as John, but there were lots of famous Johns at the time of Christ. It definitely was not John the Baptist, who was martyred even before Jesus was. Church tradition has it that the author was the Apostle John, one of the 12 disciples. He was the one who might have also written the Gospel of John, or he might not have. He definitely had a big following of disciples himself in his later years and was well known to the early Christians. It's, possible that the Gospel and Revelation came from one or a group of his disciples, but it is in the John Johannine tradition. We get our Lamb of God imagery about Jesus from him. He's very philosophical in his outlook. He's just a very distinctive in the way he writes about Jesus. His gospel is the one, if you remember, that starts by saying, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." That is quintessentially John type of writing. This John was at physically present at the Last Supper. He's the son of Zebedee, the brother of James, one of the inner trio of Jesus' best friends, Peter, James, and John. On the other hand, the author of Revelation never says he was one of the disciples, nor does he ever call himself an apostle. In fact, he speaks of the 12 apostles in the third person in Revelation. He doesn't say me and the other 11 apostles. He says the 12 apostles. Also, the apostle John made a big point of calling himself, quote, the apostle Jesus loved all throughout his gospel. That's what he called himself. And while that, and we see it in the gospel of John, it's not in Revelation anywhere. So we honestly don't know if it was this John who wrote Revelation. Even the early church fathers did not agree amongst themselves as to which John wrote Revelation or even when he wrote it. The best ideas seem to be during Nero's reign, just before the fall of the temple in 70 Common Era, or during Domitian's reign, about 20 years later. Either of these timings would work. In chapter 2, John refers to the martyrdom of a man named Antipas in Pergamum. And there's a tradition in the Eastern Orthodox Church that this martyrdom occurred in 68 Common Era. But there's also a tradition in the broader church that Antipas was martyred in 90 Common Era. So take your pick. What's important is that the destruction of the temple by the Romans happened in 70 Common Era. This was a big, big deal, huge, traumatic to the Jews. And if that happened before Revelation was written, you'd think it'd be mentioned and fire and brimstone called down on the heads of those who destroyed it. But the event is not mentioned. I personally think Revelation makes the most sense if it were written just before the temple's fall during Nero's reign, but I'm not going to argue with you if you prefer a later date. I can go either way on this one. It could be, it really could be that all this over-the-top apocalyptic suffering in Revelation is John's vision of what will happen to the Romans who destroyed the temple. So that brings me to the next point. There are at least four different ways people approach Revelation. I'm going to show you the four main ones. These are the biggies. Some people think it was written as you'll get what's coming to you, aimed directly at Rome. Folks who look at Revelation this way are called preterists, which means they think all the events in the book have already happened. Then there are the folks who don't think any of it has happened yet. They are called futurists. This is what dispensationalists are. This is where they would fall. Those folks are the ones who divide history up into segments called dispensations. Each dispensation has a different purpose. There's a dispensation of Eden or the dispensation of innocence. They have all different ones. They think that we're in the sixth dispensation now, which they call the church age, and that the events after the coming of Christ form the final and seventh dispensation. So you can Google dispensationalism if you're interested. I'm not going to dwell on it much in this class. Then there are the historicists. They don't necessarily think it was all about Rome. They correlate the different events in Revelation to various events throughout history, including current events. And lastly are the idealists, who think the whole thing is a metaphor depicting spiritual realities, not temporal ones. You can imagine, look at these and imagine how different your conclusions might be depending on how you approach the material. I personally think the material is a mix. I'll give you enough background that you can go any of these directions. This is definitely a choose your own adventure sort of book. As always, I'm going to dig underneath these layers to find out where God is in this. Whether it happened to Rome, is happening to us, will happen in the future, or is simply a vision of the spiritual forces at work in the world. To me, that is not the main point. The point is that God is in it all. We can find him in this book no matter which path we choose. And one last note before we go any further. During the 4th century, the Emperor Constantine declared Christianity to be the religion of the empire. Problem was, no one could agree on what exactly Christians believed. And he asked a scholar named Eusebius to give him a list of Christianity's 50 sacred books, and Eusebius complied. This list was not the only list, either before or after Constantine's request, but it's a great example of the state of the Christian canon at this point, 300 years after Christ, and more than 200 years after Revelation was written. Eusebius literally couldn't decide whether Revelation should be in the canon or not, so he listed it as both canon and not canon, with a little note that people were divided over it, not only because it was an apocalypse with some questionable material in it, but because there were serious questions as to whether the Apostle John wrote it, or whether it was written by some other John, or was even an outright forgery. The writer of Revelation may have foreseen this problem. Because he ends Revelation by saying, "Don't add or take away from this book, or all the plagues in this book will happen to you, and God will take your name out of the book of life." Well, don't let that scare you. As you can see, even the church fathers took this book with a grain of salt. More than 1,000 years later, Martin Luther didn't even give Revelation a page number in the table of contents of his translation of the Bible. So don't be afraid to approach this book with all your reason intact. In this last book of the Bible, we are going to use all the tools in our backpack. In fact, let's use one right now. Let's talk about what kind of literature this is. We'll take our cue from the book itself. Revelation begins by introducing itself as the Apocalypse of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show his servants the things that will soon take place. Now, that Greek word, apocalypsis, means revelation, and that's how the book got its name. But more importantly, that word tells us that the author intends for this book to be taken as apocalyptic literature. That's like the author saying their book is a romance, or a sci-fi, or a fantasy, or a documentary. When an author tells us what kind of book they're writing, they're communicating its genre, and based on that, we know what to expect. A romance will have a cute meet and a happy ending. A sci-fi will have lots of intriguing ideas, but isn't to be taken literally in the way a documentary should be. So when the author says he's writing in the apocalyptic genre, we need to take a look at what that would communicate to the readers of the day, not us. Them. In a nutshell, an apocalypse for a Jewish Christian is a story in which God shows up to rescue or save or restore Israel as an independent kingdom. In fact, as the premier and dominant kingdom in the world, with Jesus Messiah as king. They know it will be a cosmic cataclysmic story in which God shows up physically in great power, and all the bad guys get what's coming to them, and the good guys get rewarded. This is a genre. There's a whole bunch of apocalypses in circulation in the ancient world at this time. It's their version of a fantasy action movie. There are chase scenes and monsters. The good guys, that would be Israel, almost get beat. Some of them even get killed. The bad guys, that would be Israel's enemies and oppressors, have better weapons, but the hero, God or the Messiah, shows up in the end and demolishes all the bad guys. There are fires and earthquakes, stars fall from the sky, and heaven and earth implode. This is a thing in Jewish apocalyptic literature. It is a trope. It is not unique to Revelation at all. In her book, Ancient Christianities, Paula Fredriksson gives examples from two such apocalypses. In the Apocalypse of Peter, which is very similar to the Apocalypse of Paul, which were both they were both written around this time, the author says, blasphemers will hang by their tongues. Women who tempted men to fornicate will hang by their hair, their male partners by their genitals in a place of fire. Murderers will burn forever in the sight of their victims, etc., etc. You get the idea. This is typical apocalyptic rhetoric. Against some of these apocalypses, Revelation looks downright tame. The list here in the Apocalypse of Peter is long and way too gruesome to include here. I just picked the parts I could say out loud, but the end result is that the sinners will acknowledge that their perpetual punishments are just. As for the saved, they will stand in a great garden and their names are preserved in the book of life. So this is all out of the Apocalypse of Peter. It's just one example of a Jewish Christian apocalypse. So this Apocalypse of Peter was immensely popular and was known to Eusebius. In fact, he listed it in one of the groups with Revelation as a book that many, if not most, early church fathers thought should be rejected as canon, even though they thought it was still useful for instruction in the church. So, why are there so many Jewish Christian apocalypses? Well, I think it's because there's lots of gaps in the spiritual record. Throughout the Hebrew Bible, humans die in the natural order of things, but there's not much info on what happens to them after death. The ancient Israelites believed the soul went to Sheol, which is basically the grave, and a man like lived on through his descendants. But even that simple belief morphed over time as the Israelites were taken into captivity in Babylon or scattered throughout the Assyrian Empire and eventually ended up under Greek and Roman rule. Now, all of these cultures had elaborate religious myths about the afterlife. Bits of this quite naturally leaked into Jewish understanding of the gap over the generations. So, this is why, by the time of Jesus, the Sadducees and the Pharisees, both parties being Jewish, were literally at each other's throats over whether or not there would be a final resurrection of the dead. They are fighting over how to fill the gap. The Sadducees were strict literalists and kept to the dead is dead view, while the Pharisees were much more inclined to think a resurrection made a lot of sense. What the prophets in the Hebrew Bible do tell about is an end time, a last day, in which God finally shows up to save Israel from her enemies and reestablish her as his chosen nation. God and the Messiah are often conflated in these passages. In these prophecies, after Israel is saved, there is another undefined period, usually considered to be short, during which the aftermath of the battle is mopped up. And after that is a long period of great peace and joy. The wolf lies down with the lamb, people who die at the age of 100 are thought to have died young, everyone sits in their own yards, happy and well. But at some point, after another undetermined gap, there are cataclysmic events in which heaven and earth pass away, and a new heaven and a new earth are formed. Now, whether that happens before, during, or after that great time of peace and joy can depend on how you read the prophecies. That's a lot of gaps. And just like humans tend to fill in the gaps around what happened between Jesus' death and resurrection, we also tend to fill in these gaps in the prophecies. And that is where the apocalyptic genre flourishes. These stories imagine in precise detail exactly how God conquers the bad guys and sets the good guys up to rule. The ones that are Christian build on the Jewish versions and add in details about the second coming of Christ. This is where Revelation fits in the greater scheme of things. Revelation takes all these pieces and fills in the gaps in rather spectacular ways. So you can see why there was so much disagreement among the early church fathers as to whether Revelation even belonged in the Christian canon or not. Remember the Apocalypse of Peter we just looked at? It is trying to fill in those same gaps. But think about how far away from the simple teachings of Jesus this is. Jesus never said anything remotely like this. Jesus was concerned that we treat each other with love, that we are useful, working alongside our Heavenly Father in His kingdom here and now. Jesus taught that God will provide all we need for this purpose and that our Father's sole desire was to bless us and heal us and dwell with us. He wasn't really worried about our future after death or even after the heavens and earth as we know them pass away. He didn't stock his disciples up on a lot of details about any of this. He simply said, "I am going to the Father now. You know the way there. I'm going to go on ahead to make rooms ready for you." I have to tell you that I place a whole lot less emphasis on Revelation now than I did 20 years ago. I think we ought to stick with the simple faith of Jesus. Certainly, there is some beautiful imagery in Revelation. There are some warnings we would do well to heed as well. But I'm not going to focus on Revelation or even on the afterlife in my daily walk with the Lord. I'm going to focus on becoming the sort of branch that is rooted deeply in the vine and bears fruit year after year. I am going to remember that I am living my eternal life now, so I have no need to concern myself about tomorrow or what happens after my body dies. That's just a bodily transition. For now, I will care for you and for me and for God's creation with all the tools God provides. And I will trust God, as Paul so beautifully says, whether I am well fed or hungry, whether living in plenty or in want. This is how I want you to approach Revelation as well, keeping your feet firmly grounded in the here and now and in the teachings of Jesus. So as we read Revelation, we're going to consider what it might have to offer us, but we are going to guard against adding our own speculations on top of everyone else's. Okay? Are you ready? Let's begin. After announcing that this is an apocalypse given to Jesus himself for our benefit, the author, who says his name is John, says that the things in the book will happen soon, and that an angel showed all this to him. John starts with a letter to the seven churches in Asia, and he writes it sort of like a round robin letter with a few paragraphs addressed to each of the churches. These are indeed churches that the actual Apostle John shepherded during his lifetime. They're in the area of Ephesus, which is the second largest city in the empire after Rome, and the place where John's ministry has been centered. After Ephesus, the letter moves to Smyrna, then to Pergamum, Thyatira, Sardis, Philadelphia, and finally to Laodicea. You can see that these are churches in the Roman province that was called Asia at the time. John says to these seven churches, grace and peace from him who is being, who was being, and who is coming. Now that sounds like Jesus because of the coming part, but it's not. John's going to talk about Jesus in a second, but this is referring to God. Remember that the Jews and the prophecies of the Hebrew Bible don't just talk about the Messiah coming. They talk about God literally coming on the last day. God continues the greeting, saying, and from the seven spirits before his throne. Now, a lot of ink has been spilled on this one. Some translations try to force this seven spirits to be the Holy Spirit and say it is a sevenfold spirit. But this Greek clearly uses the plural word spirits here, not spirit singular. So it's time to pull out a trusty backpack tool, looking at how this concept is used in the Hebrew Bible. There's one place in particular that I think is helpful. It's where the prophet Zechariah sees seven lamps on a lampstand and is told they are the seven eyes of God. That might fit, since in a few more verses, John is about to say he sees seven lampstands that are the seven churches themselves. And knowing that John is going to draw very heavily from the prophecies in the Hebrew Bible, I think it's pretty likely that John intends these seven spirits before the throne of God to represent spirits with a particular care for these seven churches, spirits who are interceding for each of these churches before the Lord. So, however we might interpret the seven spirits, this whole passage conveys very strongly that the churches are always present before the Lord's throne and that they are seen and protected. And lastly, John's greeting also comes from Jesus Christ, first from God, then from Jesus. Although the letter is sent to these seven churches, it is being set up here as a revelation of who Jesus Christ is and the role he will play at the end time. Right away, we see Jesus as Messiah, which is what the Greek word Christos or Christ means, the faithful martyr. A word that can also mean witness or testifier. The firstborn of the dead, which is a reference to his resurrection as a human, and as king above all earthly kings. Notice that even though the Hebrew scripture and the New Testament both have numerous stories of people being raised from the dead, Jesus is viewed here as the firstborn of all who are raised. Interesting, huh? The difference, I think, is that all those other people were raised back into their regular bodies and eventually died again. Jesus was the first to be raised to an eternal body that never dies. John starts by reviewing the ways Jesus is already known to the churches as the one who loves us and who has made us to be a kingdom and priests serving God. John says he's coming among the clouds, and he quotes Zechariah 12:10, which says, "Every eye will see him, and all the tribes of the earth, all who pierced him, will mourn." Now, all of this is stuff the Jewish Christians know already. It's in the Hebrew Bible. It's part of what is now mainstream Christianity. So far, so good. But now, John is going to share his apocalyptic vision of Jesus the Messiah, a vision that is new and stunning. "I am the Alpha and the Omega." These are the first and last letters in the Greek alphabet. It's like saying he is the A and the Z. So pop quiz, who is the Alpha and Omega? Well, most folks immediately say Jesus, but the answer is God. John has switched back to God here. God is the one who says, "I am the Alpha and the Omega, the origin and the completion." It is the Lord God Almighty who John says is the one who is being, who was being, and who is coming. Then John says, it was on the Lord's Day, what early Christians would call Sunday, that while he is, quote, in the spirit, he hears a loud voice behind him that sounds like a trumpet, probably scared him to death. And the voice tells him to write down what he sees and send it to these seven churches. And when he turns around to see who's speaking, he sees someone like a son of man, human-like, who is wearing a golden belt and is standing amid seven golden lampstands. His head and his hair are white as snow, and his eyes are like a blaze of fire. His feet are like burnished bronze that's been refined in a furnace, and his voice is the voice of many waters. And in his right hand, he holds seven stars. And out of his mouth proceeds a double-edged sword, and his face is so bright, it's like looking directly at the sun. John falls flat on his face, as if he were dead, of course, but the bright one places his right hand on him and says, "Do not fear. I am the first and the last and the living one." Now, it's interesting that the Greek here is different. These are not the Alpha and Omega words used earlier, words that meant the origin and the completion. These Greek words mean the first and the last. The bright one says, "I once was dead, but now I live for all ages. I have the keys of death and the realm of the dead." Now, the Greek word here is literally Hades, which culturally these early Christians would understand as the realm of the dead. He says, "Write what you have seen and are about to see." The seven stars, he says, are the angels of the seven churches. And the seven lampstands are the seven churches. Now, I love it when prophecy, or in this case, apocalypses, interpret themselves. That's very helpful. Then the living one begins to dictate letters to each of the seven churches. Now, this seems like a good place to stop for the day. Revelation is an exciting book to study. Lots of imagery, lots of things to think about. In our breakout groups today, we're going to take a sample passage from Revelation and try to look at it through the four different lenses typically used to interpret Revelation. It will be fun to see how different our conclusions might be when we use the different lenses. And you probably don't have time to do all four lenses, so you might need to pick two, try to contrast, you know, seriously come at it and see how differently you might read a passage depending on where you're coming from.
You can tell we were still talking.
I figured you would be because there was a lot there. I mean, there was just a lot there.
We
So,
didn't get to the last one, but we did our best.
that's
Oh my
okay.
gosh.
That's okay. Talk to me about it. What did y'all mine out of this?
Confusion.
Thank you.
We have a question. The first one, how do you pronounce it?
Preterist,
Preterist? Preterist.
preterist.
Preterist. Okay. On that one, we discussed the child was Israel. No, the child was Jesus. Wait, who was it?
The woman would be who?
Yeah,
I think it was.
I think what we said was that the woman was Israel, the
Okay.
child was Jesus.
Right. And even though the
And the dragon.
dispensationalists, even though dispensationalists are futurists, that's what they believe, is that that part they believe was the birth of Jesus.
Question
So.
was, when we got to the thing about she gave birth to a son, a male child, who is to rule all nations with a rod of iron. That doesn't sound like our Jesus. Where else in the Bible
You've
do
got
they
it.
talk about this rod of iron and the Messiah?
Right. That's in the prophecies. Let me get the exact question. This
That
is
was Rich's question, by the way.
yeah, no, it's definitely in Hebrew Bible. It's quoted in the Messiah, thou shalt dash them in pieces with a rod. It's that bass solo with the rod of iron.
Our
Let's
understanding of ruling with the rod of iron is being very punitive and unyielding, and that also doesn't sound like Jesus.
Well,
But I think that
Jesus
that's
we're
what
looking
people
for.
wanted
Certainly.
was someone who would rule with an iron hand. Remember, they were looking for a king, someone who would save them. And so maybe that's why the rod and an iron rod is in there, because they were looking for someone that would be that.
Right, and it's particularly in Psalm 2 that it the way the psalm is, it's a real short little psalm, and the way it's set up is as a question is, basically, why are the nations and the people even bothering to conspire and make all their plots and plans? It says that, at some point the kings of the earth will all band together and rise up against the Lord and his anointed, meaning the Messiah, saying, "Let us break their chains and throw off their shackles." And God is going to laugh at them and say, "No, I put my king on Zion, my holy mountain." And then it flips, the psalm flips to God speaking to the Messiah, saying, "You are my son. Today I have become your father. Just ask me and I will make the nations your inheritance." Actually, it could actually not. Might not be speaking of the Messiah if you take some of the other passages into account as an actual physical king who is not the Messiah, but just actually the king of Israel who rules in Zion during that time of peace and joy, during that particular time frame. And so the Lord says to this leader of Israel, all you have to do is ask me, and I will give you all these nations as your inheritance, and you will break them with a rod of iron. You will dash them to pieces like pottery. So, and then the Lord turns back to the nations of the world and says, "So there, be warned. This is what I can do. You better go with the program." That is that psalm. And that's where that comes from.
Thank you,
You are
because
welcome.
we were stymied by that rod of iron.
Yeah. So that is something that Israel was clinging to. They're counting on that, these persecuted Jewish Christians. And, they still are actually counting on this. So what else did y'all see?
When we did the futurist, Shirley can talk to that one pretty
Okay.
good.
Well, I just was said basically what you said earlier, Gail, which was that as a dispensation, I was taught as a dispensationalist, which is part of the futuristic, and that, we believe that some of the stuff that's talked about in the Book of Revelation has already occurred, but not all of it, that
Right.
most of the Book of Revelation is still yet to happen. And Marlene was talking about her mother, who was always looking for Jesus' return, and how, 30, 40 years ago, her mother was saying, "This happened, Jesus is coming soon," and I'm like, she said her mother was like that from like 9 years old, or was that you, Marlene, for nine? And I'm
Yeah,
like,
no,
yeah,
from the
me
time she was
too.
nine until she was 91. Yeah,
Yeah,
her whole life.
and the
From a very
futurist,
young age,
the dispensationalists believe the parts that have not happened, which, as Shirley mentioned, is most of the book, believe that when it happens, it will be literally as described.
Right. And
Yeah.
like that there will be, 7 years, that half of that time is going to be a horrible tribulation. And that after the 7 years, there's going to be a 1,000-year reign of Christ, and
Yeah, but even
that's
like the
when
scorpions and the, all that kind of stuff that they see,
that
the
everything is going to
stars
be dead in
falling
the
from
tribulation.
heaven and all
Yeah.
that is very literal.
Yeah,
Yes.
the
And
moon
that's
turning to
really
blood and the sun going dark and all of
right.
that stuff.
So
We'll have a
did
new heaven and a new earth and,
so
but
how different would you behave and would you think about your life today? If you thought that, as opposed to if you were someone who was in, say, the idealist, looking at it through an idealist lens, someone who is saying, well, this is all metaphorical. This is
Yeah, we didn't
all
quite
a
get to that
classic
one,
struggle between, these are just archetypes that are, describing a classic struggle between good and evil. Marlene.
part of my, oh, sorry, go ahead, Marlene.
I was just going to say, for my mom, that was always a source of hope. But what she conveyed to me was a source of fear. Until I came to the point where I did not see it as literal anymore. Especially as a kid, it scared me to death.
It never scared me. Even when I was watching, we used to, oh, as a teenager, they brought in the movie, A Burning Hell. And then there was several other movies that came after that in the series that some church made. One was about heaven, and then, of course, when I was a young adult or a little older adult, because I guess my kids were around by the time, LaHaye came out with, I think it was LaHaye. No, not Tim
Yeah,
LaHaye. It was
Tip.
Jerry.
Yeah.
Yeah, Tim
Jenkins.
LaHaye and
And
Jenkins. Yeah,
Jenkins.
came out with The
Left
Thief in the Night
Behind.
books and Left Behind books, right?
Yeah.
And for me, it was always a source of hope because looking at it through the eyes of it's literally going to happen, and God is literally going to take us out before the tribulation, and the tribulation's literally going to be a really horrible, awful time, but I won't have to worry about it because I won't be in it. And that was always what I thought. And that's part of the reason that I was like fear and trepidation going into this because are you going to steal my hope? Which I know better. I know better, Gail. I know. But that was, like, okay, if this isn't literal, if it's a
Where is my
metaphor,
hope?
Yeah.
what does that mean?
If it's not literal, it's scary in a different way, huh?
Yeah. Well, if it's a
Interesting.
metaphor, I think we're still probably, I don't know. I'm really confused.
Well, I'm not, we're not making any, I'm not this is we're going to learn all of this stuff, and you'll see all of these views and get to decide for yourself what you think. Okay, so Julie.
All right, so maybe I was talking with Mary and Anne and Brian before, and my understanding of all this is that it's going to happen way in the future. I don't have to worry about it because I'm not going to be here, and I might as well just be the best kind of Christian I can at this particular time to my ability, because it's a moot point for me. I'm just not going to experiencing any of it. Gotcha. So I don't really have to pay attention to anything it says.
I see. All right, then.
With you. I don't focus on Revelation. I'm not sure if I'm a historist or an idealist, but I might be a combination of both. I might be all of these things, but I don't sit around thinking it's going to happen tomorrow. You know, we've been through plagues before. We've been through wars. We've been through rulers that were undesirable. We've been through all kinds of things. And we come out, and all I can do is be the person God challenges me to be, you know?
Yeah.
When I was in college, we had somebody who was teaching about the book of Revelation. And one of the things that he said was, he said, some of you are too heavenly minded to be any earthly good. And he was basically saying, you know, you're so worried about what's going to happen in the future and the heaven, and, you know, don't worry about that. Do what you're supposed to be doing right now. Mm-hmm. What has God called you to do right now? What are you supposed to be doing right now? Mm-hmm. And I think for all of us, that we're all supposed to be doing the same thing, which is glorifying God with our lives.
But that, so, and that begs the question then, is there any value in studying Revelation if you're coming at it from that point of view?
Don't know, there wasn't, but I'm giving it a try.
I'm with you,
of course,
Julia.
There's value.
I've actually read very little about it. There's all this imagery that, you know, it just is very confusing to me. It's more like, stories from the past that have all these dual meanings and whatever. And I can't figure any of it out because it doesn't have any real, it doesn't mean anything to me right now. If they thought that the seven stars were the seven tribes or something like that, what has that got to do for me right now?
Nothing. It seems like someone was hitting the peyote or something, you know?
Well, you know, I was taught that John was boiled in oil and then sent to the Isle of Patmos. Mm-hmm. And that's when the book of that's when the vision happened that became the book of Revelation. Mm. And I've always wondered if that was true.
We don't know. We don't know.
But I've always wondered if that was true, was part of this just his wild imaginings after having been boiled in oil, after being tortured that badly and left for dead on the Isle of Patmos? Was some of this his imaginings because of, you know, he went crazy from being tortured?
But it also, and it could be that, but it could also be, you know, and where I kind of lean, I think, is I think it is about the gaps. I think that like I was talking in the lesson, I think these persecuted churches, the people in his little congregations, were either beginning to be persecuted or were about to be persecuted. I mean, the writing was in the heavens, as it were. You could tell this was happening. They were scared to death. And when faced with that kind of death, they needed to know the answers to the questions in the gaps. Wow. What happens to me when I die? When will justice come? How long do I have to hold on? Now, remember, they thought Jesus was coming, and now it's been, 60, 50 years, a couple of generations worth, and Jesus hasn't shown up. What happens if he doesn't come? How do these prophecies in the Hebrew Bible fit together with, if Jesus comes right away, then what about that? How could that fulfill these prophecies in the Hebrew Bible if the timeline doesn't work? So I think he is using this apocalyptic genre to tell how this could work. He's assuming, in fact, you'll see that he assumes they know all these Hebrew prophecies, and he's just filling in the gaps. So when we read Revelation, we're only seeing the stuff he filled the gaps with, because we don't have that background in our heads of what those prophecies were that were the columns upon which he is building this house. So we get all haywire because we're just weaving in and out of this fantasy stuff and without that structure underneath it. So I'm hoping that in this class, I can bring that structure in for you at the appropriate times in the story and tell you, okay, this is what his hearers would have known. Here's the gap he's talking about, and here's what he says. And then here's what he knew. And then here's what all he says, so that you can see this. You will have to decide for yourselves whether you think this was, dictated from God and his divine revelation. I'm not going to tell you that. That's going to be your decision. Okay. I will give you the structure that to hopefully help it land for you like it would have landed, most likely landed for his listeners. Okay, Julia.
I was going to say, it's a shame Marlene's not here, because she was pointing out a lot of what, like you just were expounding on, Gail, about how this was written for the Jewish people of those times and the Christians being persecuted. She pointed that out to our group and had some good thoughts on that. And unfortunately, she had to skedaddle.
She had to leave. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anne, you have something.
Yes, I wrote down 3 points while you were speaking, which is an entire book for me. Hell. So the first thing is, I've never understood how Satan can have any power if God is all powerful. Okay. Just bump him off. Number two, and somebody mentioned it earlier, Christ came along talking about love and kindness and do things for each other, and yet Revelation is about some horrific violence. That makes no sense to me. Number three, were the Jews jealous because Rome chose Christianity over Judaism?
Interesting.
Well, I asked you for the answer.
Gail doesn't give answers. She just leads us.
Oh, okay.
Say, do you have a crystal ball, Gail?
No, I don't have a crystal ball. What do you all think about these things? So first question, she said, why doesn't God just bump off Satan? What is the whole point of all of this?
Well,
that's a good question.
I have never been one to really believe strongly in Satan. I believe there's evil in the world, but I don't believe there's a being controlling the evil or controlling us. I think it's consequences of actions that are counter to love. I told y'all the story about the t-shirt, and that's where my foundation is. I just don't believe that there is Or I believe that those who say it was the devil are looking for an excuse, not accountability for their own decisions. You know, the temptation.
Interesting.
Okay. I know there was, at a church I attended, there was a pastor who had an indiscretion with someone. And even after he left the church, I could still see comments about how she had tempted him. And it was all on her. The temptress responsibility. And I had really liked that pastor. But when I saw that continued narrative about the temptress, I just thought, how are you not taking responsibility for your actions? It's not someone creating this problem for you if you don't give in to the problem. You know?
Sounds like the Scarlet Letter.
Take care of yourself and take care of your own business and help people, and you're going to be in a much better spot, you know?
Yeah.
But when you say the devil did it, I tune out.
Yeah.
I just do.
Yeah. Yeah. Well said, Julia. That was beautiful. All right. Any other comments on that? Okay. The second point was Jesus, you know, preached peace, whereas Revelation is just chock full of violence. What do we do with that?
We said skip that too.
It.
So.
Skip it.
I know we said, yeah. No, because that goes with the rod of iron thing that we said that's not in God's character. So.
I don't know. You know, I don't know. What do y'all think? Is Revelation inconsistent with the teaching of
Jesus? It's not any different than the Old Testament. I mean, there's lots of violence in the Old Testament too.
Yeah.
And there's a lot of vengeance, and, you know, we've got the verses, vengeance is mine, saith the Lord, I will repay. And, you know, we've got the Aquila and Aquila and Priscilla that, you know, when they lied about the money and Ananias and Sapphira, sorry.
Mm-hmm. That's okay.
I know I had the wrong people. Okay. And, you know, in the Old Testament with the, you know, hid the riches that they were supposed to share with the.
That was the New Testament.
No, the other one. I'm going back to the Old Testament when they raided. I think it's David's time. When I want to say his name started with a K, that he hid the riches in his tent, and he.
No, that was back in the time of Moses. Yes,
Moses. Okay. And he and his whole family got swallowed up by the earth or whatever.
Yes.
You know.
Yes.
We see that a lot throughout the Hebrew Bible, and we see it in the book of Revelation. We don't see it much in between.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the Hebrew Bible is about prophecy and stuff, as is the book of Revelation. So, well, if you're a dispensationalist anyway, it's about prophecy. So it's not inconsistent with what we've read before, but it still seems out of character with who we know who God is.
Right?
And that's the part I'm struggling with the most.
What do y'all think?
I will say that, again, probably maybe it's just Baptist, whatever I was when I was young. The way that was all answered, at least for me, was that's how it was, but all that was under sin, and we had in the Old Testament.
Pre-Christ, you mean? Yeah.
Before Christ, yes. Mm-hmm. Christ paid the price for all that sin, so all that stuff didn't happen anymore, basically. You know, all the bad things that we were individually judged or nations were judged and all that. So Christ paid all that price by dying. And somehow his blood covers everything, and now that is not how it is. So to me, at that point, that's why the New Testament is the new way of how things should be with the love and how it should have been to start out with, but it had not been because of the fall. But that's where then Revelation at the end was then tacked on, and you're like, so what's this?
Yeah, right? So
it's coming right? From. Right? But that's, or at least in my young mind, that nobody really, and even in the church, didn't answer questions or didn't answer them in a way that you got. That's right. How I tried to look at why the Old Testament and the New Testament were so different.
Right. Other comments? And,
okay. Sorry, no, thanks.
That's, I didn't mean to cut you off, Donna. Did you have something else?
No, you cut me off. I was just babbling on.
No. Because this is important stuff. These are questions people have. Any other observations? Lumar.
Oh, I always heard something like the world was destroyed first by flood, but it'll be the fire next time.
Okay.
And so maybe this is showing, maybe God is just, you know, fed up with the way people acted all these years, and he's going to come back with fire.
Gotcha. Okay.
Maybe.
Lumar.
Well, I said this in the group. To me, just what you've shared so far has made my shoulders drop and breathe a sigh of relief, because so I was one of those people that learned about Revelation through fear and pain and that kind of thing. And I even have a couple of friends today that are trying to sell me that version of Revelation. And I just don't, I mean, I just can't, like we said, it's inconsistent with who we know God to be and who we know Jesus to be. And it helps me to know that this, or to remember, well, to know that this was written for a Jewish audience and a Jewish group of people, and that this was a genre that they were used to, that they seemed to like and enjoy, and, you know, yippee, and like a action superhero movie kind of
thing. Like bad guy, good guy, you know?
Yeah. Good against evil and good always wins kind of thing. And so just knowing that, you know, and that there are these four different, or at least four different lenses for interpretation, and that, you know, there's probably no right answer and we get to choose, is freeing. And I think that if we hold on to who we know God to be and who we know Jesus to be, I think that I'm looking forward to hearing and learning more about all the other things that were so fear creating in past studies or whatever. See where we go with all that.
Yeah.
Very much.
And you know, you will each find your own way through this. I'm hoping that the Gentle Ramble lessons, you know, all of the different series, whatever series you have been able to be part of, give you ways to look at the frames, ways to look at this that might be different than anything that would be fear giving. Because one thing I know is that God would not give us a book in order to instill fear in us. So if that's where our path has led us, and we read a passage and we come face to face with fear, we're going to back ourselves back out and say, well, that wasn't the right way to look at that. We're going to go down a different path because God. Okay. And I think that Anne's first two questions here are interrelated. The one about, you know, evil and why is there evil in the world is related to why is there evil in the Bible. Okay. And I think to some extent, like Julia was pointing out, we reverse engineer Satan. Oh. We experience evil in the world. We experience bad things. We experience death, which is part of the natural cycle of life. It is how God created these bodies. It should not mean fear. That's one of those paths where if you're afraid of death and what comes after it, you have come to the door of fear. That should be a sign you went down the wrong path. Okay? Go back, because death and what comes after it should not be anything but a opening of a door to blessing. Okay? And so when death lands on our human hearts, speaking as a widow, I can tell you, it lands hard. Right? It does not land as a good thing. It just doesn't. But I know God. And I know that in the moment where death is landing and I am grieving, that I can trust God will make it right. I can trust that God will give my loved ones back to me in a way that I can say, it was okay, Lord, I understand now. He will give back the years the locusts ate, is one of the promises in the Bible. The years that were taken from us from a child that dies too young. The Lord promises all good things to us. What we are experiencing as evil so often is collateral damage from each other, right? Okay. Is not God visiting vengeance on us? Those verses that Shirley quoted about vengeance is mine and I will repay are because God is saying, I don't want you guys to repay each other. You guys will hurt each other if you try to repay each other. My vengeance, my repayment is mercy. I am mercy. That's who God is. For God to say, I am mercy, I am love, means that all of this froth that we've, what I call reverse engineered to explain evil in the world, you know, is our imagination to a large extent, I believe. Now, I am not, please don't go out and say that Gail taught me that the Bible was a figment of her of imagination. That's not what I'm saying. Please don't get me burned at the stake.
we love you.
But what I'm saying is it's very human to do this. Okay? And Jesus spoke of Satan using that word because evil is a thing. It is a spiritual force. And where it comes from, there's been all kinds of stories in the Bible and out of it as to how that gap, filling that gap, where evil comes from and why it's still here. I relate it and to my understand, my to how death lands on me. You know, it feels one way, but I know God to be bigger than that and something greater than that. You know, and that's how I feel about evil. All right. And I just take all of these stories in the Bible, and certainly the Hebrew Bible is really easy to go through and see how it was natural consequences and how the things they wrote were there, you know, screaming and banging on the walls about what was happening to them. And they were going to do it right back at the next guy, you know, at the guy who had done it to them. You can totally see the humanity in the Hebrew Bible. It's so much easier to explain than Revelation, because Revelation is not about our humanity. Revelation is apocalyptic literature, which was an imagining of what the details might look like. Not something to hang theology on, folks. Okay.
Did we get Anne's third question?
Anne's third question was, could the Jews be jealous because Rome chose Christianity as the official religion? And instead of discussing this, since we're out of time, I'm just going to try to give you an answer on this one. It's an answer, no pun intended, not the answer, okay? But what happened was Constantine did this in 300 years after Christ. Okay. Christianity was already a thing. And it had undergone, it had survived years of persecution. His mom was a rabid Christian, and she went around the world collecting relics and, you know, all these things. She must have been a piece of work. And also because of an experience he had in a battle where he prayed and he miraculously won the battle, you know, because his soldiers had the mark of, you know, it just, it's quite a story. But it's 300 years after Christ. Well, think about what happened right after Christ's crucifixion. If Christ was crucified around 30 Common Era, 40 years later, less than a generation, in 70 Common Era, Judaism as we knew it was wiped out. The temple was destroyed. Israel was razed to the ground. Romans came in, occupied it. Everybody scattered. There were some of the people who became rabbis escaped miraculously. There's some wonderful stories about that. And they ended up gathering in other little towns, you know, out away from Jerusalem, and just basically sitting around the campfire trying to figure out now what? Who are we? We have no temple. We have no Jerusalem. We have no sacrificial system. We've been outlawed. We're on the run. Who the heck are we? And they spent these years reconstructing what Judaism was without the temple. And there was a center, it was very scholarly reconstruction. So there was a center of scholarship in Palestine. And there was a center of scholarship in Babylon, in the Babylonian, and they began write asking questions and writing down answers, and having conversations and arguments and writing down answers. Now, their response was not to come up with an answer or a little book that says, "This is it. This is who we are." They allowed difference of opinion to survive. And in my estimation, that was a strength. That is a strength of Judaism, and is what has allowed them to survive through all that they have been through. And they did eventually, after a long time, collect a body of canon, but it took them much longer than it took us. Okay. So Judaism wasn't really a choice at that point. That is the
Okay.
answer to your question, Ian. All righty. Here we are. We made it through lesson one. I'll see you next week. And